Dawkin, Sunday, 28th March, 1976. I think it might be useful this afternoon to consider the religious life in connection with certain practical problems in the world. We all know the usual accusation leveled against those who live or try to live the contemplative life or practice yoga, yoga in the true big sense, the complete sense, the accusation that these people retreat from life. That they try to escape into a fantasy world of their own. And that the sort of life they lead is one which is not particularly helpful to the world at large, which suffers from terrible problems. We all know that just at present, the world situation is a fearful one. There is such violence, such disruption and flouting of law and order, such a disruption also of values, a flinging aside of all values. Now, the question arises, is the accusation leveled against the religia truly valid? Consider how in the Buddhist world we have two main branches of Buddhism, the Hinayana as it is called, with its ideal of realizing arahatship, realizing nirvana here now, and the Mahayana with its ideal of the bodhisattva, the religious who is not concerned with his own nirvana or fulfillment, but will sacrifice nirvana and wait until all living creatures have been led to nirvana. That is the classic example of the expression of this problem. Is the religious, the holy one, the yogi, solely concerned, utterly self-centeredly concerned with his own salvation? And is he insensitive to the sorrow and trouble of the world? The fact that such an accusation is leveled or such a problem is posed before us for inquiry shows a peculiar ignorance of one outstanding fact in life. we could ask the person who accuses to answer this question. Is it at all possible for me, the individual, to exist if the world were not there? And moreover, to exist if what I call the world, the outer world, the environment, the not self, were not continuously influencing me and being influenced by me, interacting with me? We have to think this out very carefully. Is it at all possible for any living creature to abstract himself, or person, to abstract himself completely from the world? It is totally impossible to do it. Each one of us exists by virtue of the fact that everybody else exists. The animals exist, there are the plants, there is the earth, air and light and all sorts of things, the whole world. And it is in continuous interplay with each and every single individual creature, person, thing that makes up the whole universe. It is a physical, and in the case of human beings, a psychological and spiritual impossibility to abstract oneself completely from the world. So that the statement that this person is only concerned with his personal salvation, he is utterly self-centered and selfish, is an utterly nonsensical statement. It just has no meaning in fact. From this point, we can proceed to the next point. The individual and the world are in perpetual interaction. On what does my influence as an individual upon the world depend? Fundamentally, it depends upon exactly what I myself am. Whether my influence is for good or for ill, whether it's constructive or destructive, depends, or whether it is a mixture of the two, which is usually the case with practically all human beings, depends entirely upon what I myself am at the moment. From moment to moment, the world affects and influences me, and I affect and influence the world. Now, there are many people who do recognize this fact, who do know them. There are not many, there are a good few who do understand it. But unfortunately, there are too few who take the trouble to be very serious about it and apply it in practice. We must bear this in mind very carefully. Those who do try to apply it in practice because they are seriously concerned and intensely feel the ill state of the world, or most of them are unaware of the fact that you cannot thrust upon another, you cannot thrust upon the world that which is the real good. This sounds a doctrine of defeatism. It is not defeatism. If one attempts to thrust anything at all, leave alone the good, upon anybody else, there is always a reaction in that other person against you and against what you are presenting him. He may even intellectually agree that it is good for him, but he resents the good being thrust upon him. Anything wheresoever an attempt is made to compel another, there is conflict. And that which in the ordinary way we consider good, if presented compulsively, produces some ill. So you see, the problem of the religia in relation to the world is a very difficult and a subtle problem. If we look deeply into the lives of the great teachers, we will find that not one of them ever attempted to thrust down the kingdom of heaven or nirvana or moksha or liberation or anything upon another. They waited in patience. They were very watchful, alert. And as and when the circumstance moved in such a manner that the other person who was in need, in trouble, came to the Holy One seeking, then he was given what was necessary for him. And note too, he was given not in full measure. He was given enough with which to go on. If a person is given in full measure, he gets overwhelmed by it, and in any case, later on, he feels resentment against the person who gave in full measure because his own ego is hurt. He likes to feel that, oh well, I did this and achieved it. And if you hurt his ego in that way, well, he's going to turn round and rend you in some way or other. Why do you think Jesus said, give not that which is holy unto the dogs, nor cast your pearls before swine, lest they turn round and rend you? They will trample underfoot what is holy, because that ego is hurt. Give only sufficient. Quite apart from all that, there is a very sound psychological I could almost say biological reason for not giving in full. If you don't give in full, but enough to go on with, the other person exerts himself. One has to learn how to help him to exert himself in the right direction and in the right way. Now, when he exerts himself, then he grows. Otherwise, if everything is done for him, he does not grow. Supposing a school teacher is teaching mathematics, and there's a fellow who is not too bright at mathematics. If he's constantly helped by the teacher all the time, by being shown fully how the problem is solved, that fellow won't learn. He cannot learn. The teacher has to give him just a little idea here, a little push there, and say, now see how you get on from there. And that is how learning takes place. Learning is a growing. You see? So now, the world problem, one cannot give in full. Anything like a panacea or a utopia presented to the world is utterly useless. There is one type of influence which is inevitable. The very fact that each one of us exists, without our desiring to or attempting to do anything for anyone else, exerts an influence upon him. We see this phenomenon throughout the universe. Take gravitation, for example. The very fact that there is the sun, it exerts a gravitational pull upon the earth and determines the earth's movement and so forth. The other planets and so on also exert their influence, but the influence of the sun is the strongest. So we get this great rhythm of the daily rotation and the annual revolution, which plays a part of fundamental importance in the whole life of the earth. By virtue of the fact that the sun just exists, it doesn't desire to, it doesn't try to determine the movement of the earth. The sun being what it is, this happens inevitably. Similarly, with the earth and the moon. And the moon exerts its gravitational influence upon the earth. There are the tides and so on, and all kinds of things happen which are essential for the life of the earth. None of them desire to do this, that, or the other. None of them plan out wonderful schemes or anything like we humans do. But everything happens according to the laws of the cosmos, of a harmonious relationship. Now, for the religious to help the world, the accusation level that what does he do with regard to world problems? He does nothing. He just sits cross-legged or on his knees in front of a statue or something and wastes his life in useless prayers or meditations and so forth. Now, how does the religious then affect the world, apart from the fact that his very existence is constantly affecting the world. Mainly through his state of consciousness. That is, the manner in which he is aware of the world. Which will also imply the manner in which he is aware of himself. And what is the fundamental difference between the true religious, the holy one, the yogi, mystic, and the ordinary man in the world? The ordinary man in the world is perpetually conscious in terms of self and not self. And the two are separate. He says, of course I understand that we are all related and that we all interact and so forth. This is just the top layer of the brain cells affirming, spinning out certain verbal patterns. But as regards his inner awareness, which is the source of his real constructive and creative dynamic energy, he is not aware in terms of the unity, the oneness of all life of the universe, which contains him as an integral part and portion. He has not got a universal sense. He is not cosmically conscious. He is separatively conscious. This is the man of the world. But the one who is the true religious releases this cosmic consciousness. It is not by some positive active process that he releases cosmic consciousness, but simply by cleansing his psychophysical being. If his psychophysical being is cleansed, it is harmonious, it is balanced, and he is no longer aware in terms of I and mine and my in the exclusive, separative sense. He is aware all the time in terms of us, of the totality. Now, because he is aware in those terms, there are innumerable energies throughout the world. Science knows about some of them, but science is slowly discovering more and more subtle energies. It is beginning to discover how the mind, what we call the mind, plays its part. How archetypal forces and energies play their part. And science in course of time will discover all these. But the religious of the past became aware of these energies first, and only later on science came on the scene and became aware of electricity, magnetism and heat and all the other things that we know of. Now, these energies function freely through the individual living being, if he is cleansed, if he is purified. Each of us is like a receiving set and a transmitting set. We are both receptors and transmitters too. And this type of interaction which affects the world continuously goes on without our knowing it. The purer the individual, the more powerful is the effect for good of these energies upon the environment. There are people who quite naturally say, isn't all this a little bit of moonshine, fairy tale stuff? What evidence have you? Can you devise an experiment or prove this sort of thing? No, there is no experiment. There is no apparatus by which this sort of thing can be proved. But if oneself does function more and more in terms of a cosmic awareness, one becomes conscious of certain effects visible here and there. There are those who would like to say, if yogis and mystics and religious possess miraculous powers which are ascribed to them, as they were ascribed to the founders of the great religions and so on, for instance, why don't they transform the psychical atmosphere and all the rest of it by using their power? Non-compulsion is the law. Transcendence itself never compels. God, transcendence, the unborn, unbecome, unmade, the infinite, use any term you like, constantly attracts, exerts a magnetic, an electromagnetic, I'm using the terms metaphorically, attraction. But no compulsion upon not only the human being, but upon everything in the universe to come to its own proper fruition. It exerts this attraction, no compulsion. It is left, where the human kingdom is concerned, it is left to you and to me so to wake up from within that we become sensitive, intensely sensitive to this attraction and work towards it. Because one of the great things that the whole developmental process is trying to bring out through human beings is the spontaneously right use of man's power of choice and of his perceptiveness, of his own withinness, and the relationship of that withinness to the environment in which he lives. You see, these are the things we must bear in mind. If we understand them, we will see the folly of any sort of militant evangelism in any shape or form. I have got the message from God himself. The Lord God spoke to me and gave me this assignment. And in the power of the Lord, I am going out to drag you all up to heaven, make you stop enjoying the beauty of the fields and the sunshine and your lovely game of cricket which you are playing, and so on and so on. The Lord God enjoys it all himself. He never stops anybody from enjoying it. It is the militant evangelist who wants to do that. So you see, what we have to lay the greatest emphasis upon is remaining wide awake and so observant that inevitably the process of purification just goes on and on by itself. We don't even have to define what is the pure state. We don't have to lay down precisely, we must be loving thus, we must be wise thus, we must be good thus. No. Everything changes. And it must change. If I'm going to be loving thus and then stick to it, I shall just love a little bit and hate a great deal. You see, the process of transformation goes on and on. The growth is endless. It is not like the physical body, which will be 5 feet or 6 feet tall and will weigh so much and that's about all. And a tree will grow just like this and so forth. It's not like that. This growth of the mind, of the spirit, this mystery of consciousness, the sky is the limit. There is no end to it. It's infinite. You see? And its infinitude for the human being is essential in order that whatsoever of good goes out of him shall not be restricted to anything, to anybody, but will go out universally. So much for the moment as far as the individual is concerned, your religion. We can see at once that any accusation that he's selfishly concerned with his own personal salvation is sheer nonsense. The accusation has no meaning whatsoever in actual fact. Simply because he exists, he is perpetually affecting his environment for good. Assuming that he is a true religious. We must now look at another aspect. Where does the world's ill start? At what stage? And through what influences? Why are men and women the world over self-indulgent, thoughtless, cruel, and so on? Where does it all begin? How is it that men and women in the world have grown in such a manner that they are capable of ruthless murder, of violence, and so forth? Of the incredible stupidity of producing ideas like the end justifies the means. And so they'll, without any compunction, use devilish means to produce what they think is a good end. Has history shown even one single example of a good end being attained by evil means. Never, not once. People do things in the name of progress, in the name of development, of expansion. But look very carefully and see how all the forces at play bring what is apparently pleasant and desirable to this person or that person, and great sorrow and harm and evil, sometimes to the same this person and that person, plus many others. Conquests, empires, big business, all sorts of wonderful ideologies, wonderful in the bad sense, wonderfully bad ideologies, evil ideologies. And the consequence? Human misery. Now, where does all this start? Who has failed? Does it not start right from infancy? Inevitably, we condition each other. There is no escaping from being conditioned from the moment one is born. Who conditions me from the moment I am born? First and foremost, my mother and my father. My friends, my companions, my environment, the non-human environment I'm talking of, my teachers at school, all interacting with my own natural drives inherent in me. I'm not referring just to the universal human drives for the continuation of one's own existence and for the continuation of the species and that sort of thing. That is just nature. I have no say in that, nor has anybody else. It happens that way. But my own inherent possibilities and so forth. So, this conditioning is inevitable. And the parents condition the child to start with. If the child grows up into an adult who does harm in the world, who is the source of problems, surely the parents have to accept part responsibility for all that. Part responsibility. Is it not the mothers of the world and the fathers of the world, in the first instance, who have always failed with respect to their children? No blame is to be attached to anybody for this, because the fathers and mothers, they had their fathers and mothers who were ignorant, who were incapable in this, that, or the other way. The failure started right from the word go. So it is there. We have not to look at this from the point of view of casting blame or passing judgment. We have just to see the facts. Now, why are the fathers and mothers of the world so very important? Apart from the mere fact that most people will agree that their influence is paramount, usually. Biologically, not you or I as an individual is the real social unit. biologically, psychophysically. It is the family which is the social unit. Father, mother, and all the children. In ancient civilizations, they accepted this as a matter of fact, and they lived by it. As the centuries passed, and the sense of individual worth and individuality began to grow in the first instance, in the early stages I mean, then the separate individual came to be regarded as the social unit. But see what has happened as a consequence of that development. It is a development, it is an advance, it was necessary in the history of man. See what has happened. With the separate individual, and I emphasize the word separate, and the consciously separate individual as the social unit, rampant egoism came on the scene. Laissez-faire became a possibility. You see how this idea, for instance, has worked itself out through the philosophy in the Western world of John Locke and David Hume and others, and found its climax, perhaps, in the philosophies of Fichte and Hegel, with certain terrible consequences. Rampant egoism. The separate selfness became emphasized to the utmost degree. You can look into history and see for yourselves how this has worked. You can see it around in society. So, we have to go deeper than this stage. In modern times, doctors have begun to say, through considerable research in this matter, that it is the family and not the separate individual who is the true biological unit. Now note, we stop at biological unit. But those who compose this biological unit, a man, his wife, and the sons and the daughters, each one of those, if he or she develops in the right way to become, that is to say, to become aware of what it means to be a man or a woman, a human being, comes back out of the family as the unit, or shall I say, grows out of the idea of the family as the unit. He accepts that that is the unit biologically, but intellectually, where the deeps of the mind are concerned, where pure intelligence is concerned, the power to see into the truth of things as they are, he is once again a separate unit. But he is separate without separativeness. This is the important point. He transcends the isolative, egoistic aspect. So that, when he gets to that stage, he no longer bends his energies for his personal benefit or for the benefit of those whom he wishes to include within his personal circle or his own particular purview upon the world. And then the culmination comes in the realized religia, the Holy One. the utterly perfected one. He is now the individual self in the supreme sense of the word self, but simply as the perfect receptive set through which the energies of transcendence flow quite freely, without let or hindrance. So that in that person, as the individual unit, the atom of mankind, so to say, the totality shines forth in fullness, not as a single atom. But the starting point is the family, infancy, childhood. There is no getting away from that. What has happened since the last World War? All morality is being thrown overboard. Parents do not bring up their children as a whole to understand the good things of life, the truly good things of life. There is no sense of obedience to law, respect for your elders, for your equals, for those around you. There is no sense of considerateness. The children run wild. I wish, I like, I want, and I shall see to it that I do get. And this starts, I'm afraid, in the modern home. I'm not suggesting for a moment that this is universally and 100% true. There are thousands and thousands of homes where humanness is a real fact. And right relationships. But those thousands of homes are insufficient. Remember, there are 4,000 million people. And of those 4,000 million, the bulk of them are fathers and mothers. And how do they act and live? We are not brought up to respect law and order, to accept the fact of law. We are not brought up to consider deeply in cooperation. We are taught to fight for this and to fight for that. You listen to the news, you read the papers, you look at anything, they are always fighting for this, that, or the other. If there is a sport going on, it is one side fighting against the other. They will never use the word competing, which is a softer word and which is a truer word in the context. A friendly striving, a competing in that sense, is not a destructive activity. It is something which makes one grow. Because do remember, nothing grows without opposing tensions playing with each other. But when opposing tensions descend into that deadly state where any one of them says, I must win out and destroy the other, well then of course you have evil. Now this, I have just mentioned the field of the home, which is really a very important field. I know there are so many problems. All homes are not father, mother and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 children, whatever they may be. There are all sorts of extraordinary situations all over the place. We know that. But one has to do the best that is possible under the circumstances. And the question arises, well, how is one, what does one mean by doing the best under the circumstances? To answer that, we have only to consider this point. On what do I set my sights? Do I set my sights upon acquisition, upon imposing my views or ideas, or compelling somebody else to do this, that or the other, to gain, to become a tycoon or goodness knows what not? Or are my sights set upon living in such a manner that the purpose of my existence as a human being naturally comes to fruition? We have time and again considered this business about the purpose of our existence in various forms, so we won't go into that now. But if our sights are set upon that, then our sights are set upon transcendence itself, the supreme good, the supreme truth, the peak point of what we call religion. Because that which distinguishes man from all other species is his conscious religiousness. And if man can release this fully and realize a spontaneous everyday life which is a true communion with the totality, then transcendence, God, call it what you like, realizes itself through that man. So we set our sights on transcendence, not as something to be achieved or acquired. Because you can't achieve or acquire transcendence. I can only purify this, open my eyes, be awake, and transcendence does all the rest. So if we do that, if we devote ourselves to the religious life with that kind of understanding, then the problems which exist in the world today will be affected by ourselves in the best possible way, to the supreme degree possible. But if I spin out ideas and ideologies, make plans and this, that and the other, those ideologies and plans and so forth are inevitably self-oriented and self-centered, and they are spun out of a brain which knows only a tiny little bit and no more. So it's useless. Who sustains our life here on this planet? The sun and the planet itself, and the moon. Those are the three most powerful factors which sustain our life. Can you and I sustain our lives to anywhere near the extent to which these forces sustain our life? It is the same with what am I to do in the world situation. It is difficult to wake up to this. It is difficult to see it. But you know, the world condition is very critical. And particularly our condition in Britain is becoming more and more critical. You cannot stem the tide of evil by pushing against the tide. The tide itself is the tide of life. Life today has become poisoned. We do not want to stem the tide of life. We want to transmute that poison. And the transmuting of that poison is fundamentally through waking up to the reality of transcendence, functioning through all its manifestations, of which each one of us is a self-responsible expression.